Downloads of this show are available on Podomatic.com and the Podomatic mobile app.
I am Velocity Child, and every Friday at the stroke of midnight, ride the broomstick with Fallen Woman, a weekly psychic fusion of forward thoughts, far-out ideas, magical foray, and spellbinding song. Stirring up the cauldron at Radio Free Brooklyn.
The Jungian Storyteller Series. Warming the Stone Child. Myths and stories about abandonment and the unmothered child. Session 2. With Dr. Clarissa Pinkola Estes.
I think that the unmothered child material shows up most poignantly in adolescence. I think that sometimes it's hard to tell that a child has been abandoned until they come to adolescence, which has everything in the world to do with identity. Identity means I know who I am today, and I expect to be the same person more or less tomorrow and next week and next year. In adolescence, of course, we don't even know who we are 5 minutes ago, let alone next week. And we're constantly changing and trying to figure out exactly where to root ourselves. It's sort of like a walking tree looking around for a piece of land to put itself in. And a couple of the things that happen in adolescence are profound loneliness. And adolescence has loneliness in it, there's no doubt about it. But when I say profound loneliness, I'm talking about melancholia and a gnawing hunger that is so horrible that people may even entertain suicidal thoughts. Not because they really wish to kill themselves, but because it's so hard to live with that kind of pain. It goes on, and there's no known medication for that kind of pain of being lonely. Also, in adolescence, there's another quality of coldness that often comes over people. They are unable to relate to their peers. They have no friends. They don't speak to anyone in the family. They don't talk to the neighbors. They don't have anybody to go to school with. Or even if they do have friends, they feel cold inside, as though they're locked up and they aren't able to act, even in their own behalf. Or they have many, many accomplishments, and even so, they're not able to feel any sense of accomplishments. That's another kind of coldness, where you are surrounded by bounty, but you don't feel bountiful. Some adolescents become extremely icy and aloof. They carry a facade of cynicism that makes them seem as though they really don't like anybody, including themselves. And then all these symptoms point to having had something go drastically wrong in the process of being raised up in an atmosphere that makes people free instead of making them captured and incarcerated. So the psychic life of the adolescent is tenuous anyway. It's like trying to juggle lots of things but not being a juggler yet. It takes practice. The problem for some adolescents who have been abused is that they don't feel they have anything to juggle. Whatever there is laying before them is, you know, the two oranges and the apple. It looks to them like a nothing. It looks like it's hopeless, like they're worthless. And for others, they cannot make themselves begin to practice because they're afraid that they will fail, and they fall into a terrible depression. And one last thing I want to say about adolescence before we leave that subject. Have you ever wondered why some people seem to share the same experiences in adolescence, but one is practically brought to their knees by it, and the other one seems to go whistling through it with their head held high and sort of dancing along? You know, people are born with different constitutions. If you go into a nursery, At a hospital, you can see it immediately. There are some babies who are very sound sensitive, and they'll cry and weep at any kind of noise. And there are other babies who could sleep through a thunderstorm. And psychically, there are different temperaments too. There are people that I call sensitives. And it is true hell for a sensitive to be unmothered and abandoned, because they are the people who, if you just scratch them, they bleed. They are the people who are like the skinless man. They walk around with exposed nerves. And of course, a great deal of their task in life, particularly as adults, is to grow skin. It's a very important process. Growing skin means learning not to take so deeply to heart everything that happens to them, to not read into all the looks and all the words that they receive, but to just take them at face value. That's an example, incidentally, of where intuition can sometimes work over time. It can work against the person. Many sensitives are psychic, highly, highly intuitive, all the way into what I would call the psychic spectrum. As a result, they hear things and words that aren't there consciously. They may be in the person's unconscious. And they need to stop hearing, feeling, and seeing those things, unless it's a situation that they need to evaluate for harm to oneself. They need generally not to pay attention to what the deep unconscious of the clerk in the grocery store is saying to them as they ring up their purchases. I mean, that doesn't make any sense at all. However, for adolescents who are sensitives on top of the whole thing, and unmothered as well, it's a very, very torturous time. And that's the bad news. The good news is that, for the most part, that can be sutured and healed. And when I say for the most part, as you well know, you cannot heal the things you will not feel. And so feeling what all the wounds are is very important. And you know that those things do leave scars. So it's never going to look like you never suffered. Although I say that be proud of your scars. It has everything to do with your strength and what you've endured. It's a map, so to speak, a treasure map in many ways to the self. The deep self. Speaking of the deep self, one of my favorite stories is a story I collected up at the Chukchi Sea. It's an Inuit story. It's called The Stone Child. And I know that you'll identify with this as I do. There was an orphan who was so lonely and so hungry that no one wanted to be near him. His mouth was open all the time, and his teeth were always showing, and tears were always running down from his eyes. And he was so wild with hunger that they had to tie him in the entrance to one of the skin houses so he'd not try to eat the hunters on their way to the seal hunt. That's how hungry he was. They would, on occasion, leave him some rancid reindeer meat, or maybe some spoiled intestines to eat. But as we know, it was more than hunger that was gnawing at him. Those deep needs that not even the person themselves understands. So every day he stretched his chain a little bit and a little bit more until he could get near a stone that was more or less the same size as himself. You see, his mother and father had died one night, and their bodies had been dragged off by bears, and all that had been left behind by them was this one particular stone. And so he wrapped both his arms and legs around that rock, and he wouldn't let go of it. And of course, his people thought he was crazier than ever, and on their way home from the hunt with animal carcasses slung over their shoulders, they would jeer at him, and they would say, "Analuk has taken a stone for a wife. Ha ha! It's good for you to have a wife who is a stone, for then you cannot use your hunger and eat her." And they went on their way. But the boy was so lonely and so hungry that he really had reached the end of his feeling for life. And even though he had that terrible loneliness and that gnawing hunger, he kept his body around that stone. And because the stone began to take the heat from his flesh, the boy began to die. And the stone took the heat from his hands. And then it took the heat from his thighs. And it even took the heat from his chin, where he rested it atop the stone. And just as the boy was living his last breath, the hunters of his village came by again on their way home from the hunt. And again they called him down and they said, "You crazy boy, you are nesting with that stone like it's an egg. We should call you Bird Boy, you good-for-nothing creature." And because the boy was near death, his feelings were hurt more than he could ever say. And great icy tears began to roll down his face and across his parka. And his cold, cold tears hit the hot, hot stone with a sizzle and a hiss and a crack, and it broke the stone right in two. And inside was the most perfect little female the boy could ever want. "And come," she said, "I am here now, and you are an orphan no more." And she gave him a bow and arrows and a harpoon she had brought with her, and the boy and the girl made their house and had babies. And if they are not yet dead, they are in that land where the snow is violet and the night sky is black. They are there living still. In this part of the circumpolar region, many of the stories have many different endings depending on who's telling the story. This story of the stone child has another ending that I heard while I was up there. And it is that the boy begins to drag the stone around on a leash, sort of as though it's a dog, except the stone doesn't do any work. The boy does all the work. And he drags the stone from village to village, and people come out and throw things at him and chase him away and tell him he's no good and they don't want him and he's a crazy man, and otherwise why would he be hauling this stone around? And so he goes from village to village, and finally there's only one more light off in the distance, and he is truly dying. And he thinks, "I will take this stone to one more place. And if there is no one there who will give me food or shelter, then I will lie on my back on the ice and I will die." And he got to the house of skins, and when he went inside, there was a bundle of furs and hides that spoke to him and said, "Oh, I am glad you are here." And he was very frightened. He thought it was a ghost. But you know what it really was. It was an old woman. She said, "Oh, my people are away and they're hunting and they haven't come back for many days. And I am here and I have meat, but it is frozen. And I have a cooking pot and I can boil water to make it warm, but I don't have a stone to put in the pot, so that the house will stay warm all night long." And the boy said, "Well, oh boy, it's a good thing I have a stone and I can put it in the pot." And he thought, as he picked up the stone, he heard a little voice coming from the stone saying, "I can help, I can help." And he put the stone in the pot and poured water in, and they set the fire under. And the stone heated up, and they put the meat in, and they sat happily, contentedly watching the stew boil. And the boy thought he heard the stone say, "I love you. I love you." The orphan in the story, the stone child, is the unmothered one. And you know, oh, that hunger that can grab hold of the unmothered. It makes people do crazy things. It makes them be with bad people. It makes them fall into rotten love affairs. It makes them stay too long at jobs they hate and despise. It makes them do things that are not in their best interest. That's the kind of wild hunger, the kind of terrible loneliness that the orphan psyche has. And sometimes people get so wild with it that they really have to be tied down. They have to be made so that they don't hurt others in this sense, other parts of the psyche. You know that when we have an obsession, and I speak of this more in terms of having an obsession with another person more than any other thing, when we have an obsession, we can't think anymore. We just drive toward that one thing. We're so hungry for it. We feel that if we could just consume it, we have this tremendous infantile hunger. That if we could just consume this thing the way a baby practically wants to eat its mother's breast all up and swallow its whole mother to satiate itself, if we could just do this thing, that we would not be hungry anymore. We would not be lonely anymore. If we could just pass through the body of another person, if we could just rest in their body and against their spine, if we could just be that person, we would be fulfilled. Well, that's a very dangerous thing. And so to tie oneself, in many ways, of course, means to restrain oneself, to put this hunger close to the outside of the psyche. You know, the entrance to an ice house is actually, it's like a little tunnel that you crawl through on your hands and knees to get to the larger part where you can stand. So being tied in the entrance means not all the way in and not all the way out. In other words, contained. You're not acting it out, and it's not so deep on the inside that is buried in the unconscious. And to be fed rancid reindeer meat, spoiled intestines, and so forth. That is what the Inuit will eat under the circumstances of famine, not having successful hunts, etc. The Inuit are, if not the last, certainly the second to the last of the hunting cultures in the entire world as we know it. And their entire lives are spent looking for food. And out on those great ice floes, in that land that's white from horizon line to horizon line, there is not a great deal that moves. So to feed the psyche, to feed the child in the psyche, to feed the orphan self, spoiled or rancid things, means just simply not having very much to give to oneself, not being able to give self recognition, compliments, acknowledgments, whatever it is that it is we give to ourselves that is rich. So he stretches a little bit every day, more and more, until he can get near something that his parents left him. His parents have been dragged off by bears. In other words, instincts, basic and base instincts, have somehow run away with his parents. His parents, for all practical purposes, in other words, just simply cannot respond to him. That means the internal parents in this psyche are not able to respond. That guiding light, that consciousness we were talking about earlier, for some reason, it just is not present, but it leaves something behind. Rocks are considered the substantial and ancient symbol of earth, of being down to earth, of being in the ground, of being tied to the real and to the material world. And when I say material world, I don't mean the world of Corvettes and Ferraris. I mean the material world in terms of the life that we have to live in the outer world. So he wraps his arms and legs around this symbol of tremendous stability, of the Mother Earth herself. That's what that rock is. It's the archetype of the mother that is within the psyche, that is invincible, that is ancient. And he wraps his arms and legs around her and would not let go. It's that the psyche has a thought that if I can just stay close to the earth mother, if I can just stay close, say, to the land, to trees, to water, you know how nurturing those things are to the unmothered. They are incredible. If I can just stay here, if I can just hang on, well, it gets made fun of. And that represents the part of the psyche that harasses. That's the introjects that we were talking about earlier, where you get a shot of things, of negative thought and feeling that really isn't yours. It comes from outside you, usually from your parents and those who are in authority. The loneliness and the hunger kept the boy close to that stone. In other words, it's the very loneliness and the very deep desire to be whole that pushes the person toward the archetypal mother. Except in the story, the stone begins to take this new potential, this emotional potential's heat away from. It begins to drain the heat and sort of heat itself up. Well, this is an incubation period. This is a time during which the psyche does require great heat, very much like a hen that sits on her eggs. In this case, it is a matter of the psyche giving its all, giving everything, giving all its energy, all its time, all its thoughts, all its feelings to this process, this egg, this Mother Earth, this archetypal presence that it really doesn't understand. It's just hoping with great intuition that something will come of this. And that's what often happens to us psychically, is we don't know what we're doing. We just put, so to speak, all our eggs in one basket. We do psychotherapy. We do dream analysis. We meet a person who's a great teacher for us, and we put all of our hope, all of our faith, and all of our trust into that. And we sure hope something's going to come of it, even as it drains us sometimes of our resource, of our feeling, and sometimes even of our hope. Remember, the darkest hour is just before dawn. And so this boy begins to cry, and he doesn't have hot tears, he has icy tears. He has icy tears because he's losing his warmth. One way of interpreting that is that he has some distance from his feelings, and that can be positive or negative depending on the person. His tears are icy, meaning they're not warm, they're not close to him. Perhaps, in the best sense, something is melting. Perhaps, in a negative sense, he's not real close to his feelings, as people who are abused are not often close to their feelings. And the tears roll down his face across his parka, and they hit the hot stone, and they crack the stone open. It's that the coldness or the distance of emotion hits the heat of emotion, and somehow magic happens. The egg is hatched, it's cracked, and what comes out? But true feeling in its purest, most perfect form. The most perfect little female the boy could ever want. And she gives him the implements with which to live life, the guidance, in other words, the light, the consciousness. She gives him bows and arrows and a harpoon. And they marry, and they have children, which psychically, in a fairy tale or in a dream, means to make an amalgamation of the emotional life and the intellectual life or the spiritual life and the life of matter, and to bring those together in harmony or in a balance that continually rebalances itself throughout life. And to have babies means simply to have new potential being born all the time out of your psyche, to have new ideas, new hopes, new dreams. In other words, for the flame within to burn very brightly and very strongly. In the alternative ending to this story, the stone child, the boy drags the stone about, and he comes upon the feminine in a totally different way. Instead of being a little female, it's an old woman. An old woman who cannot keep the house warm, and the house is often represented in dreams as the ego. Cannot keep the ego warm, cannot stay feeling balanced, in other words, ego-wise in the outer world, cannot stay consciously balanced because she doesn't have the stone. She doesn't have that thing which in this story ending causes heat to be held and to be radiated out over a long period of time. Now think about it for a minute. Wouldn't it be wonderful to have a mother source within you that holds the heat or the light always and continues to radiate it all the time. In other words, you have a flame or a fire within that is your spark of life. It is your spirit and your soul. And that there's a stone there that it also heats. It's sort of like solar heat in the psyche. And that causes its radiation throughout your spirit, throughout your creative life, for always and ever. It's a perfect internal psychic heating system. So all these things are the corrective experiences that the unmothered child needs. They definitely need a stone to warm the life, to bring true feeling into the life. They definitely need intuition. They most certainly need the light of consciousness. Here's another corrective for the unmothered child. It is a story about people who drive themselves to do and acquire and experience. The unmothered child often wants to grasp things, is so afraid that they'll go away, that they won't be there when they need them. They take perhaps more than they need in order to maybe have it for later. They hoard things. It's very good for an unmothered child to understand that nothing is leaving the planet, all in its good time. Good things will happen. You don't have to grasp at them. There's a fairy tale about that called The Fisherman's Wife, and it's about an old man who goes out fishing every day, and his kindly little wife lives in a hovel at the edge of the ocean. And one day while he's fishing, he catches a flounder on his hook, and the flounder speaks to him and says, "Oh, fisherman, if you will let me go, I will give you anything you want." Well, the fisherman was a very, very kindly old man, and he just felt so bad that he had caught a fish who could speak. He said, "Oh, no, no," and he took the hook so carefully from out the gill, and he set the flounder back into the water, and he went home, and he told his wife over tea, and he said, "You know, today I had the most remarkable experience." And he went on to tell her what. And instead of her usual kindly response, she said to him, "You fool! You should have told him we needed a nicer house. Look at the way we live." The old man said, "Well, you know, I'm sorry. I didn't think of that." And the wife said, "Well, you go out and you find that fish and you tell him we want a nicer house." And the old man said, "Well, perhaps you're right." And he got into his boat, and he went out into the ocean, and he called out, "Flounder, flounder in the sea, my wife Elsinore would have me speak with thee." And up came the flounder on a wave. And the old man said, "I'm really sorry to say this. I should have asked the first time, but, you know, my wife really would like a nicer house, and I was wondering, could you do that?" And the flounder said, "Of course, go home, it is done." And the old man rowed back home, and certainly there was a really nice house, white stucco with a red tile roof. It had flower pots in every window. It had a little horse and cart outside. It was wonderful. And that night, he was laying in bed with his wife, and he was thinking how lucky he was. And she turned to him in the night, and she said, "I'm not happy." He said, "What's the matter?" She said, I'm just not happy. I think you should go back and you should ask that fish if I can be king. I would like a castle and I'd like courtiers and I would like an army and I would like all those things." And the old man said, "Are you crazy? Look, we have this really nice, we've never had such a nice house. What are you talking about?" She said, "If you don't go back and talk to that fish, I won't love you." The old man felt very hurt. He thought, well. So he reached for his slippers, and he put on his rain gear, and he went out in the middle of the night, and he called up the fish, "Flounder, flounder in the sea, My wife Elsinore would have me speak with thee. And the flounder came up on a wave. And the old man said, I'm really sorry to bother you, but my wife says she would like to be king, and she'd like to have a castle and an army and courtiers and, you know, all that sort of thing. And could you? And the flounder said, go home. It's already done. And the old man rode home, and sure enough, there was a castle with flags flying and a great big moat around it and a drawbridge. And there were men in armor, and there were ladies in waiting. And that night, as they lay in bed, and he felt pretty good about what he had done. He lay there smoking his pipe. She turned to him, and she said, I'm not happy. He said, yeah, now what? She said, well, I would like to be Pope. I would like to be Pope, and I would like to have a crozier, and I would like to have that hat that popes wear, and I would like to have the Pope's slippers, and I would like to have cardinals all around me, and I would like to have all the beautiful things, all the paintings, and all the gold. And he said, look, you have now more than anything we could ever have imagined. Go to sleep. She said, I won't love you if you don't go. Get that for me. He put on his slippers and his rain gear, and he went out, and he rowed the boat, and he called up the flounder just like he had the past two times. And he said, flounder, I am so apologetic, but my wife wishes to be Pope. And the flounder said, go home, it's already done. And the old man rowed home, and sure enough, there she was, all in her white robes, with her mitre and her crozier and her Pope's slippers. And that night, in the great big golden bed, he was smoking his pipe, and it was dark, and there were stars twinkling through the window, and he felt at peace at last. And she turned to him and said, I'm just not happy. He said, woman, what is wrong with you? She said, I'm not happy. I have been thinking about it, and I would like to be God. I would like to be God, and I would like to have a seraphim and a cherubim, and I would like to have a heaven. The old man said, look, look, old woman, give it up. This is totally silly. She said, if you don't go and get this for me, I won't love you. The old man put on his slippers, and he put on his rain gear, and he got into his boat, and a storm was coming up, and it was the middle of the night, and the moon was covered over with a dark cloud, and he sailed up the waves and down into the troughs. And he called, flounder, flounder in the sea, my wife Elsinore would have me speak with thee. And the flounder came up on its tail on the very top of a wave, towering over the boat that was bobbing in the midst of all the rush of water of the ocean, and said, now what do you want? And he said, my wife, I am so sorry, my wife wants to be God. And the flounder said, she has asked too much. Go home, old man. And the flounder sunk beneath the water and swam away, leaving a small trail of red blood behind. And the ocean settled and became calm, and the old man rowed home. And as he came to shore, he could see the dawn of the morning rising behind the little hovel where he and his wife lived, and where now his wife sat on the front porch peeling apples. So to synthesize some of this, you know, if you're going to bring it all down to one simple statement, the unmothered child is very much like The old man who was sick and lying in bed and death came in through the window, and he suddenly remembered that he had a sword under the bed, and so he got up and he fought a sword fight with death back and forth and back and forth, and he won and he chased death out the window, and then he laid back down and actually he felt stronger instead of sicker for it all, because he had fought the battle and he had won. And the stone child also fights a battle with death. Isn't that what's at the bottom of all this, is death? A fear of dying as a result of being alone, whether it's in the forest, whether it's out in the ice fields or the ice floes, out in the ocean, no matter where it is, of being alone, of coming to your death all by yourself because of no guidance, no help, no care, because of being made fun of, because of being called ugly, because of being let alone, because of being carried out into the woods to die. That's what this is all about. It's about defeating death. You know, there's a time when we all will die. But this kind of death, this psychic death we're talking about, is a kind that should never happen to anyone. And the story of the stone child is a sad story because he is so near psychic death that he might not make it. And that is the truth of the unmothered child. And that is the triumph of the unmothered child. It's a tremendous battle fought and a tremendous battle won. As I said at the beginning, it's not just a matter of surviving. It's a matter now of thriving, creating things, a good life, good relationships, good feelings, expanding into all the corners, becoming full and abundant. In Jungian psychology, as one person put it, who is not a Jungian, he said, "Oh, I get it. Jungian psychology is about feeling good when you feel bad." And you know, that had truth to it. The tragedy of the unmothered child is that it makes people either icy or totally weepy all the time, neither of which is very productive. The important part is learning that there is something good that can come out of all that suffering. And these are the stories that I've given you to show what can come of suffering and of fear and of being backed into a corner, as Red Cap was, for instance, of being so alone and so isolated from people as the stone child, of being pushed and pushed to get bigger and better and more, to try to fill oneself up with phony things, like the fisherman's wife, to lose the light and despair, and feel like you'll never make it, you'll never be conscious enough, you'll never get this stuff figured out, you'll never be able to get rid of those haunting thoughts of the way that you were treated. That's what all these stories are about. It's fighting death and winning. So, now what? We have all these nice stories, and we have all these lovely interpretations. And how are you going to tease out the thread that will start you on your own journey or take you in a more fertile direction? One of the best ways, of course, to do it is to pay attention to your dreams. Your dreams will tell you everything. In terms of injured instinct, dreams that are about animals that are injured or are not acting properly are very good clues to what is hurt or what is injured in the deep unconscious. So certainly one way is to pay avid attention to your dreams. A second way of doing it is to remember back to childhood your favorite fairy tale and to consider that that fairy tale actually became your myth, the guiding light of your life. And if that fairy tale had a really rotten negative ending on the end of it, then you may wish to choose a new ending. You may wish to actually sit down and write, to play, to act, to mask make, to dance a new ending to that fairy tale. If the fairy tale has a positive ending, let's not say a happy ending, let's just say a positive ending. And sometimes when people get eaten up in fairy tales or destroyed, sometimes they were so negative to begin with that that's a very good thing. But let's say that in one way or another, this favorite fairy tale you had as a child had a perfectly wonderful ending to it. Then see what you can do to live that out. See what you can do to bring that true in your own life. Each of us have a story like that, sometimes a couple stories like that, that we relied on all of our life to give us hope and to give us strength, whether we consciously realized it or not. When I was a child, I was totally taken with a story called The Dog Who Had No Home. And it was not a fairy tale, it was just a children's book that was written in the 1940s about a dog who kept trying to find a home. He had been let off somewhere in the middle of nowhere. And he went from house to house, he got yelled at, he got chased by other dogs, he got stones thrown at him, and so on. And finally, near the end, he's tired and weary and hungry and thinks really that he'll just lie down and die, but he sees a light at the end of the railroad tracks and he thinks, I'll try just one more time. And there's a little house at the end of the tracks. And when he scratches feebly at the door opens and it's children, filled with children who are having a birthday party and who think that he's a gift. And so at last, he is accepted. Stories like that are the stories that make us hold on to the stone so that we can crack that egg and let out our feelings, our true self. Those are the kinds of stories that lead us through their symbolism and through understanding their psychic meaning to the grandmother's house where we put the stone in the pot and as a result we're all warmed. Those are the stories that lead us to developing our intuition and using it and saying, this is right, this is my life, this is the way it should be. It's the story and the symbols in the story, whether it's a dream or a fairy tale or even a movie or a book that you've read that you're really taken with. There's a reason why you're so taken with it. It's because it resonates to the deepest symbols within your own psyche. And it's that that leads you to the stolen mother moon and makes consciousness rise back up the way it ought to be to light the way in the dark. If you are an artist, a writer, a poet, a painter, a sculptor, a dancer, a thinker, an idea maker, if you make babies, metaphorically or otherwise, then you have a natural ease with symbols and with stories. And frankly, in my deepest heart, I believe that everybody is at least one of those kinds of artists, if not several. And so I wish for you a strong story to lead you from the unmothered child to a fully developed inner mother who sets your creative life totally free. And I tell you once more, in order to guide you, a partly burned piece of wood always has a red ember at its center that with a small wind will glow and burn brightly again.
I was brought up through darkness. I am light, but was a light in the darkness as well. When I was innocent, I learned about sin. Just them, Mom and Dad, whipping me with double belts both at once, no one holding me down, flailing in pain, on a couch over his golden stick of gum. But blacker times lay ahead. I've seen a black snake moaning all my young days. From performing a stepdaddy's cheap $20 weekly full-body massage to a mother who couldn't love. But the blackest snake moan was on the ceiling of my 5-year-old bedroom, my dark spirit guide sitting beside and all around me as I looked down below watching my daddy mess with me. He made me pick out the belt, but it wasn't about the belt. It was about my ass. Black Snake Moan told me, child, you don't have to do this if you don't want. I realized the truth, and in that moment everything went black. All I was the blackest black eternal. And I fell from my spirit spot on the ceiling, back into my body, laying across his lap, then onto the floor, and the door slammed shut. Flung it back open and pointed to his bloody gut, screaming, look at what you did to me. Then I saw his blood under my nails. And you know what? He never touched me again.
Black snake come after me.
all in my realm. Black snake all in my realm. Please, pretty mother, get this black snake away soon. Black snake is evil. Morning, black snake moved in on me.
Sometimes I feel like a motherless child. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child, a long way from home, a long way from home. This world out here is lonely and cold. This world out here is lonely and cold. This world out here is lonely and cold. I guess I'll go back home. I guess I'll go back home. Why did I leave the ones that I love? Why did I run away? Now I pray to the Lord above. Let me go home and stay. Let me go home and stay. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child. A long way from home. A long way, a long way from
Velocity Child, and every Friday at the stroke of midnight, ride the broomstick with Fallen Woman, a weekly psychic fusion of forward thoughts, far out ideas, magical foray, and spellbinding song, stirring up the cauldron at Radio Free Brooklyn.